The new blockbuster film Nuremberg with Russell Crowe has brought the issues of war crimes and the Nuremberg trials once again into public focus. Russell stars as the Nazi war criminal Hermann Göring, who was the head of the Luftwaffe in World War II, Adolf Hitler's designated successor. He was said to be the second most powerful man in Nazi Germany.
The governments of Russia, France, Great Britain, and our United States will put these men on trial for their lives.
It can't be done. There's no international law to base the charges on.
The world needs to know what these men did.
You want to know why it happened here?
Because people let it happen.
I am a prisoner because you won and we lost.
Not because you are morally superior.
We are able to do away with domestic tyranny only when we make all men answerable to the law.
So that it can never happen again.
Yeah, well, that was the hope, wasn't it? And hopes were high. There were parallel trials of Japanese war criminals held throughout the Pacific between 1945 and 1951, before interest petered out, too. It was felt that, that executions and jail terms ordered by those courts, that governments, defence forces and individual combatants would know that if they committed a war crime, then they would face dire consequences and severe punishment. That was the case after the war, but how's it going now? Well, the answer is not so well. We hear the term war crime used a lot these days. It's applied to Israel's defence forces' killing of civilians in Gaza, Russia doing the same in Ukraine on what seems like a daily basis, citizens starved in Sudan, forcibly displaced in Myanmar, and most recently, of course, the US military's lethal attacks on suspected but not proven drug boats off the Venezuelan coast, including disturbing reports of the perhaps machine gunning of survivors in the water. There's usually a disclaimer added that it's suspected, possible, maybe, etc. In his latest book entitled World of War Crimes, barrister and human rights lawyer Jeffrey Robertson argues that legislation against war crimes has no real-life existence, that military forces ignore them, governments lie about them, and there are always defences and very few perpetrators are ever prosecuted. He would like to see that change. He joins us this evening. Jeffrey, good evening to you.
And, good evening, Philip.
Welcome to Nightlife. It's great
to have you
with us. Tell me the history. How did the idea of war crimes come about? I mean, we know about the Geneva Convention.
It's been around for a long time. I've traced it back to 1139, to the Lateran Council of the Catholic Church, which issued a decree saying it was an international crime to use the crossbow in wars between Christians. You could use a crossbow to spifflicate Muslims, but you couldn't use it in wars between Christians. So that's the first international war crime. But then we look at the Henrys, the Tudor period, you get kings passing laws against the rape of women and the killing of prisoners. And by the time we had the British civil wars, we had three armies, the Scots, the kings, and parliaments. They all had or made it an offence, a capital offence, to kill a prisoner or to someone who was out of the combat. If someone was drowning, if you killed him, that would be a crime. So you get these armies that have their rules, and in the American Civil War, they were codified by a brilliant jurist called Franz Lieber, and the Lieber Code became something that was followed by armies. But of course, this was basically for soldiers. We had our own soldiers who were convicted and hanged in the Boer War for killing their prisoners, and so it's been around.
Well, though, that was under English law. That's right.
It was.
Breaking Morant.
That's right. So unfairly tried, but nonetheless,
he was a war criminal.
He was. Yes. So that's a It's been around for a long time, but actually prosecuting leaders for aggression. I mean, let's face it, Vladimir Putin is the worst man in the world for starting the war in Ukraine and killing up to a million people of his own and Ukrainians as well. So it's only recently, only with World War II, did we actually prosecute the big criminals. But because the First World War, they decided that they'd put the Kaiser on trial. And Woodrow Wilson, the American president, didn't want to do that. He wanted Germany to be part of his great idea for a League of Nations. So he vetoed that. And, of course, the Kaiser was never tried, as he should have been, for the invasion of Belgium and for ordering unrestricted submarine warfare. He lived on safely in the Netherlands. And so it was really Nuremberg that was the beginning of war law that would encompass the leaders of states.
In the current situation, Geoffrey Robertson's my guest. If you'd like to ask him a question, 1-300-800-222 is the number. There are lines free. A couple of texts already saying, in relation to the United States committing alleged so-called war crimes against alleged drug boats. As one of my texts that says, there's no declared war between Venezuela and the United States, so isn't the United States just committing murder of
citizens? In a word, yes, it is, because there is no declared war other than in Donald Trump's imagination. These boats, the families of the dead men say they're just fishing boats. There is no evidence that they're carrying cocaine, and even if they were, this is an extrajudicial execution. It is not, except in rhetoric, it's not a war. But if, the interesting thing, if it is a war, then the killing of the two survivors is a war crime. It has always been, since 1918, when a boat carrying Canadian nurses, a hospital boat, was sunk by a German submarine, and the submarine surfaced and then machine-gunned the nurses and the sailors in life rafts. It's been clearly a war crime. A German court, totally biased in favor of Germany, actually found these Germans guilty. And in the Second World War, the British hanged several captains of U-boats which had surfaced and machine-gunned survivors. And this is what happened in the Caribbean when the boat, the first strike of the boat, killed nine of them, and then two of the sailors were seen clutching onto the wreckage. Then they were killed. The order was given that they were killed by certainly an admiral and probably by Trump's Minister of War, Secretary of State, used to be for defense. Now it's of war, Pete Hegseth. So it is a it's a war crime, and it raises questions about Australian cooperation with America in situations where this admiral, this secretary for war, have any command responsibility because they're just they're war criminals.
The use of the word war crime, of course, supposes that there's some means of, I mean, if we use the word crime in ordinary life, we talk about a crime which is something that's been designated by the state as a crime, but there is also a police force to apprehend people who commit these crimes, and then there is a court system to bring people that are apprehended before the courts, and they receive punishment and then held, you know, they are punished or are held in custody under the authority of the state. I mean, when we talk about war crimes, there's no apparatus like that at all, is there? Other than the International Criminal Court, which the three most powerful countries in the world are not members of.
That's right. And, of course, that's a court of last resort. The emphasis is on local laws where people can be arrested.
Mm.
And that sometimes happens. If war criminals venture abroad to meet their girlfriends or take their families on tours of Europe, they sometimes are picked out.
And that has happened.
Yeah. I've given evidence in one case against an Iranian torturer who killed a number of people, and he was jailed for life, and then Iran in Sweden, and Iran arrested a couple of innocent Swedes and held them under a fake charge until their war criminal was released. So even when that happens, there can be ways out.
Hmm. When you, I mean, people, you refer to these things in your book, and people use the phrase, you know, the laws of war, or this, you know, shouldn't have happened. We've had these debates in Australia over Australian forces, special forces engagement in Afghanistan, for example. You know,
yes.
And when there have been some celebrated cases here. And we say, you know, we use phrases like this, you know, this was soldiers on the ground know are specifically instructed in this. They know what they can and can't do. And
they know they can't kill survivors of boats that they've sunk. And this raises questions for our cooperation with America.
Has there ever been, in your experience, because I can't think of one, a war that's been conducted according to the laws of war?
Well, there have. The question is, has there ever been a victor who's been put on trial?
Mm.
And there has in my, usually, war crimes, convictions are imposed on losers, those who are available for trial. But there have been some cases where they have been my own court in Sierra Leone, where I was presiding judge, tried one of the, in effect, heroes who had defended democracy against a most barbaric outfit. But he defended it by recruiting child soldiers to help him. So he had to be prosecuted, sadly, for recruiting child soldiers in the course of beating back this barbaric force. And there have been notable cases where even America has acted. You may remember, if you're old enough, William Kelly,
the Mylae massacre,
who ordered his troop to wipe out a group of villagers in Vietnam. He was convicted and jailed, and then President Nixon intervened to make sure he didn't spend any time in jail.
That's right.
And there was a recent case of Clint Lawrence, who was a dreadful fellow who was in command of a troop of American soldiers. And as a couple of Afghans were passing on a bike, he ordered them to shoot and kill them. And there was no reason for him to do that. And his troop, some 12 or 13 of them, were so outraged at this war crime that they gave evidence against him, and he was convicted and jailed for 20 years. But then Pete Hegseth, who was not a fighter, he was a commentator on Fox News, decided that this criminal was not a criminal, he was a hero, and persuaded Trump to pardon him, which Trump did at the end of his first term of office, saying that he wasn't a war criminal, he was a war hero. So that
here we go again. What's that phrase of Thucydides? I'm sure it's in your head. The strong do what they will, and the weak suffer what they must.
The weak suffer what they must. That was said in about the turn of would have been about 100 AD.
1-300-800-222 is the number. Kim from Parramatta, if you'd like to ask Geoffrey Robertson a question, it's an opportunity to ask Geoffrey Robertson a question and give him a call. 1-300-800-222. G'day, Kim.
Hi, how are you?
Pretty well.
And first of all, I'm a great admirer of Geoffrey Robertson. I think he's a fantastic lawyer. The question is, if one side is not playing within the rules, okay, so for example, these boats are in fact carting drugs and they're just doing willy-nilly and it's actually a state-sponsored thing. And the other side is actually playing within the rules, right, and makes proper arrests, but then it's actually leading to 130,000, a big, you know, issue in relation to the society itself, in relation to drug addiction, then why should play fair, considering the other side is not playing fair? That's my question.
Yeah, okay. Geoffrey?
Well, what do you do? You could intercept these boats and see whether what they've got in a bag is fish or cocaine. And if cocaine, you can arrest them and take them to America and prosecute them, since America is their final destination as planned. That's fine, and you can jail them for a long time. But there's no death penalty for importing cocaine. No American state has that. But the alternative was what Trump is doing is simply killing them, executing them, without giving them the opportunity of fair trial, the opportunity to show that they're not as guilty as they may seem, or that they've been under duress and so forth. So that's the difference.
The proper thing is to apprehend the boats, isn't it? put the people on trial. Kim, what do you reckon about that?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's a valid point when you're playing within the rules. Okay, but the thing is that because the actual drug problem in America is leading to 130,000 deaths of their own people because of drug addiction, because of the influx of drugs, then what type of message does that leave the person willing to risk $1 million, whatever it is, to have a go importing drugs because they don't particularly care? A couple of 30 years. Some of them will get away with it and say, "Hey, I'm a rich man now."
Yeah.
But that's not the drug problem in America, does it?
No, I get that.
But it's interesting that it's not via the Caribbean that fentanyl and cocaine come into America. It's actually through Mexico and overland. So this is really just a display of utter arrogant power by America, which sees itself as above the law.
What are we, Geoffrey? We use the phrase war crime. What's a war anyway? Because I'm trying to think. I don't think Australia ever declared war against Vietnam, yet we went there and killed soldiers and civilians there. So the Americans did in large numbers. I don't think we declared war against Afghanistan or Iraq.
Once upon a time we did declare war,
No one does that anymore, do they?
No, they don't. It's you look at what they do, which is bombing and killing, and you describe that form of conflict as a war if it's brutal enough or large scale enough. But it's quite clear you separate wars into international wars where several countries are involved, or civil wars, which are wars inside a country. But that gets complicated because international forces support one side or the other in civil wars. So the whole concept of declaring war is very old-fashioned.
Alex in Collingwood has sent a question saying, does Mr. Robinson consider that Israel has committed war crimes and genocide against the Palestinians?
Well, Israel has killed about 70,000 of mostly children, women. The breakdown I don't have immediately to hand, but it is so much more than what I consider probably the worst crime. It was Hermann Göring's crime, although it didn't feature in the film. It was the Blitz. The Blitz went on for 9 months. And
you mean this is the London, the bombing in London?
The London, the bombing of the poor people in the East End, deliberately killing them. That caused only 43,000 deaths. So it's interesting that if you look at those figures, that the Israeli Defense Force kills 70,000, far more than were killed in the Blitz. And you've got to judge whether this or that is a war crime. You've got to look closely at the circumstances. I consider that the death of Zomi Frankum, who was that Australian woman who had been giving aid and assistance with one of the registered aid groups, I consider that was a war crime. Israel Netanyahu said, oh, it was a mistake. Well, it wasn't a mistake. It was a crime. In having looked at that evidence, I won't bother you with it now. So I think that there are a number of cases. I'll give you this example where the Israeli Defense Force killed 50, even 100 people in a refugee camp in order to kill one Hamas fighter. Is that now it? you've got to be proportionate in your attacks where you're justified. And let me make clear, Israel was justified in taking measures of self-defense and in tracking down the hostages and trying to convict the hostage takers. So Israel was justified to that extent. But to the extent of killing 50 refugees in order to kill one Hamas fighter, I don't think that a war crimes judge or a moral philosopher would say that that was proportionate.
There'll never be any account of this, though, will there? Because who would hold the IDF to account for this?
Well,
because there's no body in the world that will do this, and the only one that it could possibly do that, I suppose, is the United Nations.
The, ICC,
the one thing your book is very, very scathing of the UN processes. But
well, the
ICC,
International Criminal Court could. It's indicted Netanyahu for using starvation as a strategy of war. So that is, if it can prove that, and there are question marks over that. Nonetheless, if it could prove that starvation of civilians was being used as a tactic of war, that certainly would be a war crime. It would fall within the ICC's province.
Is the ICC worth having? Because its powers are very limited. It can't compel anybody to front up to its court. It can't enforce its own sentences. What's the point of it?
My point is that it would have a point if it could have trials in absentia, because that would enable the great result of Nuremberg was that it gave a written judgment that put the Holocaust beyond any doubt. It proved that the Germans killed 6 million Jewish people and were intended to eradicate them. So that was the great result of the trial. No one could argue with that. It was there in black and white. So that is the advantage, one advantage, of having international courts. It's not to punish war criminals or have them executed any longer. We don't do that. But it is to provide a tested record of their crimes so that people can't deny them. And that, at least, is the advantage of having criminal trials of war criminals.
Mm. Quite a few texters asking about Vladimir Putin.
Yes.
And his appalling behavior, crimes, and attitudes.
Mm.
One of my texters saying, what can we do about Prime Minister Modi of India sucking up to Putin and treating him like a rock star in India right now?
Yes.
When the man is, you know, I think any fair-minded observer would say, is a war criminal of you know.
Well, I have no hesitation in saying that Putin is the worst man in the world, because his action of invading Ukraine, a free UN member, has caused almost a million deaths or dismemberments of his own people and of Ukrainians' people. So that's more harm than any single individual has caused. And it is a case that he can be prosecuted, but he will most unlikely that he will ever hobble into the dock like some old Nazi and be prosecuted, unless he is overthrown like Milosevic. So yes, the day may come. But on the whole, it's not likely. So my urging has been that the ICC adopt or take the power to have a trial in absentia, so at least the evidence can be presented and he can be proved to be guilty of aggression, invading another country and causing thereby the deaths of so many people.
Was the dropping of an atomic bomb on Japan, particularly the second one, a war crime?
Well, I think that the first bomb, and I'm not, I don't have everyone supporting this view, but I think the first bomb was justified, and I look at the alternative, which would have been the invasion of Tokyo, and I look at the massive numbers of people who would have died as a result. And I can understand Truman and Churchill, who made the decision, believing on a simple benthamite calculus of that it was easier to, and Oppenheimer had estimated 20,000. It was thought that 20,000 would die because they didn't know about ionizing radiation as a result. They thought that it would be justifiable because they would have hundreds of thousands of deaths of American troops and a few Australians as well, and 500,000 at least of Japanese. So on that basis, the first bomb was justified. I didn't think the Nagasaki bomb was justified, even though the Japanese hadn't immediately surrendered. I think that once the Hiroshima casualties had been assessed, I think they would have done. Mm. But I have to say, I might be biased in this. My father was an Australian fighter pilot who was actually teaching at the age of 22, and he had volunteered to fly off one of the British aircraft carrier that was marked to be part of the invasion of Tokyo. So I guess he was due to report for duty on the day that Hirohito, the emperor, admitted defeat. And he didn't, for that reason, risk his life in the invasion of Tokyo, which would have been a bloodbath.
Yeah, indeed. Questions, 1-300-800-222 is the number. Lines are free if you'd like to speak to Geoffrey Robertson. Graham in Perth. G'day, Graham.
G'day, Philip and Geoffrey. My question is very general. The question is, are witness protection programs affordable and effective to keep the witnesses alive up until the trial?
Okay. it's slightly off topic, but what do you think, Geoffrey?
Well, I think so. We've just had a strange case in Britain where Mr. Scalapino, who was the lead informer on the IRA, was comfortably ensconced in a witness protection program, and there was an entire organization, the IRA, who wanted to kill him, and he died in his bed from a heart attack, and people are now thinking that, in fact, with the help of MI5, he killed more people than he saved. So that witness protection program was effective. In fact, MI5 and the British police used to send a lot of their criminals who needed protection, gave them a new identity in Australia. The Australian government, it never told the Australian people that it was allowing British criminals to rebuild their life here, but it did. And so I don't know what the figures for witness protection in Australia are, but it certainly has been effective in Britain, less so in America.
Okay. Mary in Hobart says, given Geoffrey's view on the Blitz, I'm interested in how he regards Bomber Harris's intensive bombing of German cities. Well, yes, in particular, would you regard the firebombing of Dresden, for example, not a particularly military target? Would you regard that as a war crime?
Yes, of course, and it is. Bomber Harris has been an enormous embarrassment to Britain, rather like Curtis LeMay, who was the mad dog American in charge of Bomber, the U.S. Air Force Bomber Command, and he set up the Tokyo bombing, which killed 100,000 civilians, and he was still in charge of Bomber Command when the Cuban Missile Crisis erupted some 14 years later, and he advised Kennedy to deal with it by bombing Cuba, which would probably have caused World War III. And it was to Kennedy's credit that he resisted. But, I mean, I wrote this book after a year of watching television with children being dug out of the rubble in Ukraine and Gaza. And it made me think, why isn't it a war crime to bomb civilians, to bomb their residences, to bomb places where you know they're going to be and be killed? And, of course, I trace it back to our old friend Hermann Göring, because in Nuremberg, there he was, sitting in the dock, the only Nazi member who, Nazi leader who was available. He was there in place of Hitler, and he had run, he had ordered the Blitz. He was the head of the Luftwaffe. And so why wasn't he prosecuted over the Blitz? And I'll tell you why he wasn't, because I've seen the the ruminations. They were afraid that he would run what is called the tu quoque defense. It's Latin, but it means, yes, I did it, but you did it too.
Which and we did. Unquestionably true. Unquestionably
and
true.
In Dresden and a lot of other German cities that we leveled, 600,000 German civilians were killed thanks to Bomber Harris. Mm. But that was the reason why Nuremberg didn't come up with a finite war crime of bombing residences indiscriminately. That should have been war crime that was alleged against Hermann Göring and proved, but the Allies didn't want to go near it because they had been guilty of it as well.
1-300-800-222 is the number. Brian from WA. G'day, Brian.
Yeah, hi, Phil, and hello, Robert, Geoffrey. I'm intrigued by, and it's so complex in Israel, Palestine, to what Geoffrey might say about Hamas taking hostages. Those hostages were taken from areas that were previously owned or occupied by Palestinians. The hostages, is it that the hostages could be considered invaders of previously occupied areas by the Palestinians, and therefore does the word hostage change? So I'm wondering what your opinion is about that.
Who's the hostage and who's the prisoner? You finish, Brian.
Well, it's interesting, but there's one clear view. The Geneva Conventions of 1949 are very clear that hostage taking is a most serious war crime. There is no defense. And the taking and killing, well, 1,000 were killed and there were rape, and it was quite an obscene attack. And Israel was justified in hunting down the hostage takers and taking proportionate reaction. But at the same time, you've got to remember that there's a long background, that in fact the International Court of Justice this year made clear that the a lot of the West Bank and a lot of Gaza was originally a Palestinian land. In fact, the last time I went to Israel some years ago was to give a lecture at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and I started with a kind of, it used to be Palestinian land, so I thought I'd start with a welcome to country, with welcoming the Palestinians. Mm. I thought it might catch on, but of course it didn't, and there is perhaps no attitude as the kind that we have towards our indigenous people. You don't find that in Israel.
As a matter of jurisdiction, given that Australia is a signatory to the ICC, we're a part of it.
Mm.
If Australian Special Forces managed to capture Vladimir Putin in India, spirit him back to Australia, could he be put on trial here?
Yeah, well, he'd have to be handed over to the ICC.
But would Australian courts have jurisdiction to try him for these crimes?
I would think they would if we had if he was charged with, certainly with Australian soldiers who've been killed or imprisoned by Russian forces. Mm. And we could, I think, prosecute him here, but the likelihood is that we would hand him over to the prison in The Hague, at Scheveningen prison, and that's where he would be held. But all hell would break loose. He's got 5,000 nuclear weapons at his beck and call, and it might be a case of law giving way, as it sometimes sadly does, to power.
Mm. Luke in Kodunyup. G'day, Luke.
Yeah, g'day. I'm just a follow-up question on what you said earlier about the proportionality of Israel's response to the Hamas attack. As an occupying power, doesn't that separate things in terms of international law? I was wondering if you could expand on that a little bit. I think it's separate, my understanding.
Yes, it's interesting. Israel is an occupying power, as decided by the International Court of Justice. It is not, as Mr. Netanyahu sometimes claims, it is not the historical owner of the Israeli lands. And as an occupying power, it does have an international duty to care for the people in the occupied territories, not those that are criminals, not those who resist, but in general, it has a general duty to care for them. And that general duty is, in the view of many, has not been taken up by certainly not in the West Bank, where a number of so many prisoners have been held.
Luke? May I follow up on that?
Or? Yes, yes, Luke.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to ask, to what extent then, given that the Hamas-led attacks, they're a group under military occupation, to what extent are those attacks that happened on October 7th a crime?
Well, I believe that they are because they were, first of all, there were a lot of murders. 1,000 people were killed, and they were innocent civilians. And secondly, several hundred people were taken hostages, which is a war crime under the Geneva Convention. So at that level, the fact that it was occupied land was not directly relevant. It certainly may be as a mitigation factor, but I can't see that the actual killings can in that way be justified under international law.
Mm. Okay, Luke.
What about the against military and police forces, excluding the civilian deaths?
Yes, I would exclude. There may be a justification for the killing of some 200 policemen, but certainly not for the young people who were attending the music festival. All for the people, whether they were policemen or not, who were taken hostage.
Thanks, Luke.
Yes, right.
Thank you, Luke. Yeah. All of which begs the question, Jeffrey, is of what is to be done, which is the eternal question.
Note there is no war crimes tribunal in the Trump plan. Trump has no idea of war crimes. He doesn't believe in them. He believes that certainly America and its allies can do what they like with their enemies. And so in neither the Russian plan, which Trump has crafted with the help of the Russians, but not the involvement of the Ukrainians, there is actually a proposal for an amnesty. Everyone is going to be amnestied. We know that Russia committed that horrible crime of bombing 700 women and children taking refuge in Mariupol in the theater.
Yes.
We know that in Bucha, the soldiers shot and raped a number of civilians, but they're all going to be amnestied, which means that they are not going to be, they're going to be forgiven for those crimes. That's Trump peace. And we know that as far as Israel is concerned, the proposal is not to take any notice of crimes at all. Trump pleaded for Netanyahu to be forgiven for the corruption. Who cares about champagne and cigars, said Trump. And, of course, Netanyahu is being prosecuted for accepting corrupt gifts. So there it is. There is, in the view of Trump and his rather low-life ministers, there is no such thing as a war crime. Wars, you can do what you like so long as you win wars, but prosecuting the your own people is not appropriate.
No, well, that would be the history of it, wouldn't it? Your contempt for the Security Council and the UN apparatus is evident throughout the book, and I don't want to ask you about it because I don't think anyone wants to argue with you with you about that. But finding a way forward from this, you kind of advance a high-minded argument that like-minded and high-minded countries should band together without the US to set up a better system. It's a pipe dream, even if it's not an unattractive one, I guess.
Well, I think democracies have to do something because the authoritarian countries can block anything. Russia vetoes any UN action. America vetoes any action that would bring about or embarrass Israel. China will veto any action against it if it invades Taiwan, and so it goes on.
We are going to have to wind this up. Jeffrey, I'm sad, and plenty many listeners sending in texts too, saying sad it has to be wound up too, because it's terrific to have your expertise with us as well. But I do thank you for your time. Jeffrey Robertson has been our guest tonight. Thank you, Jeffrey. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Philip.
Bye-bye. Jeffrey Robertson joining us. Fascinating conversation.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.